Hello and welcome to our Energy Recharge Coaching Module on Carbohydrates. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo and I'm excited to talk to you about this subject, which tends to be very misunderstood, very confusing, a lot of conflicting information out there, and I'm sure all the conflicting information leaves you quite confused. So let's get started. And before we begin, let me make sure that you understand that this information is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not medical advice. It's intended as a sharing from my knowledge, my clinical experience, my research to you. And I would encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based upon your own research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare professional. So let's just do the bird's eye view. Let's just do an overview first of what we're going to learn. What are carbohydrates? Introduction to the carbohydrate family members. It's a fun family to read. Food sources of carbohydrates. What's the difference between refined carbohydrates and whole carbohydrates? How do you know what carbs work best for you? And what are some of the therapeutic diets out there that are related to carbohydrates? And finally, what's best for you? Low, medium, or high carb intake. It's really important for you to make that decision based on how your body reacts and based on some signs that I'll share with you. So, let's get started with what are carbohydrates. What you see on the screen right now is a picture of a glucose molecule. And glucose is the cornerstone of all carbohydrates. And a lot of people don't realize. We look at glucose as sugar and sugar is bad. But indeed, glucose is at the heart of every carbohydrate, including vegetables like broccoli and carrots and beets and spinach. So it's not bad. It's the context in which it's done. That's not whether determines whether it's good or bad for you. So what are carbohydrates? Well, they're large molecules that consist of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen atoms. Usually the ratio is 2 to 1 of hydrogen to oxygen and relatively equal amounts of carbon to oxygen. So let me say that again. It's oftentimes, usually the formula for most carbohydrates is about a 2 to 1 ratio between the hydrogen and the oxygen and carbon, which are usually equal, but not necessarily 100% of the time. So the formula chemically, and I won't geek out too much on chemistry, but it's important to see some of the chemistry to really understand this, is C6H12O6, that's glucose. And that's what you're seeing on the screen. And it's usually formed in that shape. And we'll look at some other sugar molecules and see that some of them are shaped a little bit differently. They're basically hydrates of carbon, like water, H2O, plus carbon. So you can see that that formula fits, right? CH2O, carbon plus water. And that's basically what they are. They're also known as saccharides. And you're going to see this word a lot, and I want to make sure you understand what the various saccharides are. There's a monosaccharides, which is one sugar, which is what you're seeing right there, glucose. There's disaccharides, which are two sugars. And I'll give you an example of sucrose, which is a combination of glucose and fructose. Oligosaccharides, meaning short chains of saccharides, between 3 and 9 sugars generally. And then polysaccharides can be, you know, many. So we'll look at all of these to try to demystify it a little bit, because I think when you break it down to the building blocks and you demystify it, you get a better sense of what's what and how it all works. So let's look at the function of carbohydrates. Energy, right? Because what? Glucose is the energy currency that gets into the cells and then does the magic of the Krebs cycle to turn it into ATP or energy. So they're not structural like proteins. They provide fiber for intestinal function and to help keep things moving through you in a nice steady pace. They can also provide spare protein for use as energy. So, or they can spare protein for use as energy, because when your body gets low, blood sugar gets low, or you're in an emergency situation, oftentimes protein is broken down, and there's certain amino acids called branched chain amino acids that can be used for energy. So if you have enough carbohydrate in the diet, then you can spare the protein. But because otherwise, if you don't have any carbohydrate in the diet, protein and fat are what's going to be used to try to make you energy. And they're also sometimes carriers for the transport of proteins through the blood. So they'll be molecularly bound to protein in order to carry them around. So let's look at carbohydrates in foods. And we got a picture at the bottom, which includes a lot of carbohydrates, some refined, some not, some simple, some complex, some good for you, some not so good for you. We've got sugar, candy, white flour, anything. These are all simple carbs. White flour, anything, crackers, cookies, pizza crust, cake, bagels, white rice. It's another simple carb, and all kinds of flour products. And there's some debate about whether if you take like whole grain, so hey, say whole grain rice or whole grain wheat, and then you grind it into a flour, is that really a simple carb, or is it still a complex carb? Because after all, it hasn't been refined. The rice grows in the whole state, in the brown rice state. It's got bran and germ, and those contain a lot of the nutrients, quite frankly. When you take those off, you're left with the white, just pure starch core. Yeah, there's a few other things, but most of the B vitamins and minerals are stripped away, as well as the essential fatty acids that are in there to begin with. And so when you take a carbohydrate and you refine it down, what happens is it increases the rate of absorption. So everything, they're all sugar molecules, even your broccoli contains sugar molecules. But it's because of the kinds of fiber and how intact the food is will determine how quickly it will get absorbed as sugar. So we know that if we take a whole grain, compare it to a white grain, in general, the whole grain is going to be absorbed. The sugars are much less, more slowly absorbed than the refined. If you blend a food, it's going to make it more highly absorbable and more rapidly absorbed. And if you juice a food. So for example, if you enjoy vegetable juice and you make yourself a big cup of vegetable juice without the fiber and you drink that down too quickly, the sugars that you've released in there can actually raise your blood sugar. So it's real complex the way this all works. Suffice it to say, a very simplified, an oversimplification perhaps, is that simple carbs tend to be less nutritious and more adversarial, meaning worse for your blood sugar management. Whereas complex carbs tend to, in general, be a little bit more slowly absorbed and still have a lot more good nutrition intact. So let's look a little bit further at the complex carbs. We have legumes. You know, those are things like, you know, beans and lentils and things like that. They're considered complex carbs. They have a fair amount of protein, a fair amount of carb, probably around equal, you know, give or take a little bit depending on which particular legume you're looking at. But the complex carbs in the legumes tend to make them be more slowly absorbed and not be as detrimental to raising blood sugars. But again, that differs from person to person. We've also got whole grains. And when I say whole grains, I don't mean flour. I don't mean whole grain muffins. I mean whole grains, the way they grow. Quinoa, millet, whole wheat, which I don't recommend at all because of the gluten. Rice, brown rice. These are the whole grains versus the refined. And nuts and seeds have complex carbs in them. Nuts and seeds are not a big source of carb, but they do have carbs. You know, most of our foods have a combination of protein, fat, and carbs. And so the nuts and seeds, while they're mostly fat, a little bit of protein, and a little bit of carb. And then vegetables. Vegetables are loaded with complex carbs, and they're in a very tight structure within the fiber, the cellulose, which tends to slow down the absorption. And fruit's a complex carb, although in some cases it acts more like a simple carb. So if you eat a banana, it may tend to raise your blood sugars quickly because the sugar from the fruit gets into your bloodstream quite quickly. Same thing with the very juicy fruits that are sweeter. So it's a matter of perspective as to whether you're going to adversely react to it. Tubers in root vegetables, so things like carrots and beets and potatoes and all, those are more complex carbs. Although we could argue about potatoes because the potatoes cause the blood glucose to go up quite rapidly. So let's talk about monosaccharides. We talked about the fact that the starches, the carbohydrates, are saccharides, mono, di, oligo, or poly. Mono, di, oligo, or poly. So we're going to start with mono. Mono means one. So monosaccharides are carbohydrates that contain one sugar molecule. So there's three different ones. There's glucose, there's fructose, and there's galactose. Glucose is found in a lot of different places, and it looks like this. Another way you might see it, if you see it depicted, is like this, but the carbons are not written in the ring. So either way, that's glucose. It's a single sugar. Very common in nature. Some of your fruits have a lot of glucose, like grapes and bananas tend to have more glucose than fructose. But most of the fruits actually contain more fructose. The fructose still has six carbons, but it's structured differently. The ring is actually five carbon ring, or actually it's not all carbon, one of them is oxygen. So the ring is actually five atoms, and in glucose it's six. So you can see that one of the carbons has been moved out. And again, you sometimes see it without the carbons listed, and it would look like that. Now, galactose is milk sugar. And it looks very, very similar to glucose. In fact, to the naked eye, it's hard to tell what the difference is. And so, if you ever did, when you're a kid, those one of these things is not like the other, well, you can look at glucose and galactose and see that the only difference is right here, where the position of the hydrogen and the OH, which is a hydroxyl group, are flipped. That's it. So galactose is the sugar that's found in milk. And that's what that looks like without the carbons showing. So we're going to go through all of these and then we'll go into more of the practical stuff. I just want to give you a sense. You're not going to remember all this. You're not going to, but you'll recognize and you'll understand as we talk about bonds and breaking the bonds and how certain carbs are easily absorbed and others aren't. You'll understand it more when you have a little bit of an understanding of this, of the science. So here we have disaccharides, and we have three disaccharides: sucrose, lactose, and maltose. Sucrose is the one you hear most commonly. It's common table sugar. They derive it from beets sometimes, or cane. Cane is actually a good source of it. But sucrose is two molecules, one glucose and one fructose, and they're holding hands. You see the O in between them? That's oxygen. Oxygen pulls them together. So they're holding hands. So think about sucrose as glucose and fructose going steady. Okay, that's what they are. Now, to break those down into the monosaccharides requires an enzyme to break that bond at the O, to kind of tear their hands apart. Lactose consists of one glucose and one galactose. And you'll see, one has the OH up there, the other has it there. And again, it's a bond between them which contains oxygen. And again, breaking it down requires an enzyme. And then maltose is two glucoses. And maltose is what we're typically going to see in starches. We're also going to see a long, 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 long string of maltoses to make what we call a polysaccharide, which we'll talk about in just a moment. Next, we're going to talk of the oligosaccharides. And some of the oligosaccharides you may have heard about. Oligosaccharides are just a few, up to about nine, some books say up to 12, but no more than that. And they're glucose and fructose or glucose, depending on which of the oligosaccharides we're talking about. One of the oligosaccharides you might have heard about is called fructooligosaccharide. And the reason I say you might have heard about it is commonly put in probiotics. So it's fructooligosaccharides. And the commonality between oligosaccharides is that our bodies don't really break them down. They're resistant to breakdown. And they end up going down into the large intestine intact, which makes them food for your good gut bacteria. And they're not so pleasant for the bad gut bacteria. So the picture here shows us with the glucose and fructose bound together. And there's some number of those in the middle and then one on the end. So it could be 3, it could be 5, it could be 7, it could be 9. Fructooligosaccharides can be very helpful for people with candida or fungal overgrowths because they tend to provide fuel and food for the good stuff to help it grow. What we see on the right-hand side is parts of pectin, amylose and amylopectin. And these are fibers, and these are hard to break down. So that's another oligosaccharide. So let's look a little bit more closely at fructooligosaccharides. They're good food for bacteria, gut bacteria. They're not digestible by pancreatic enzymes. So the bonds between the molecules don't break down well from the pancreatic enzyme, so they escape intact lower down. So we don't get to take the fuel from it. They're also known as prebiotics because they feed the probiotics. And there's a little diagram to show you what they ought to look like. So where do you get these? Well, you could take a supplement that contains FOS, or you could look for food sources. And I've listed a good 10 or 11 foods that contain it. And they're not uncommon foods. It's not that hard to get. Jerusalem artichoke looks like a little baby potato, and they're available in most grocery stores and health food stores. Yacon is a syrup. It's actually a root, but it's mostly sold as a syrup. But yacon comes from South America, and it's very strong for good oligosaccharide. It has something called inulin in it. Blue agave, which I don't recommend because of the high sugar content. Bananas, which I say proceed with caution about until you know for sure if you are blood sugar sensitive. Onions, which are a very therapeutic food for those who can tolerate all the sulfur in them because they're very, very cleansing. Chicory root, garlic, asparagus, jicama, potatoes, and leeks. So those are all good sources of FOS, fructooligosaccharides. So let's look at polysaccharides, because we've already looked at mono, which is one sugar, di, which is 2, oligo, which could be anywhere from 3 to 9. Let's look at polys. That's kind of what a starch molecule looks like, right? You just see this string of sugar molecules all holding hands, all going steady. And then there we have glycogen. And where starch is a plant concept, it comes in plants, you know, like starchy vegetables, starch in grains, that sort of thing. Glycogen is actually starch in your body. It's where your body strings a whole bunch of these glucoses together and stores it in your liver and muscles so that you have ready fuel when you need it. And if you've ever heard about athletes the night before a big event, they will load themselves up with carbs. I don't think it's a great idea, but they do it. And the reason is to help build up the glycogen stores so they have lots of glycogen as they're doing their event and they don't burn and they don't run out of fuel. So let's look at cellulose. Cellulose is also glucose, by the way. Cellulose is a non-digestible starch, fiber, and it comes in lots of different foods. And we'll talk about that in a moment. It comes in all your vegetables, and it's the hard surface, the structure that also can bind up nutrients. So that's why it's really important to chew. All right, let's talk about a very controversial and also quite confusing topic, and that's sugar alcohols. You'll also see them referred to as polyols. Even though they say it's alcohol, they don't contain any ethanol. They just have OH groups that are considered alcohol. Their sweetness is similar to fructose, so you actually need less of it than you think. They take fewer calories than sugar. They do this. And they're naturally occurring and chemically delivered and don't raise blood sugar. So that's all the things to know about sugar alcohols. The big thing is that they're used as substitutes for sugar. When people are trying to go and do a low-carb diet, you may have used them yourself. So some of the sugar alcohols, there's erythritol, there's sorbitol, there's mannitol, and there is xylitol. Those are the main ones. And those guys are sugar alcohols that can provide that sense of sweetness and satiety for a short while. The reason that sugar alcohols don't raise blood sugar is that we mostly can't metabolize them. They just don't get broken down by the pancreatic enzymes, so they're not metabolized into sugar, and they just go through the intestinal tract intact. And when they get down to the large intestine, they tend to feed or be fermentable by some of the bacteria back there, in particular the not so good bacteria. So if you do have an overgrowth of some sort of undesirables down in your gut, then you probably will have a little bit of trouble with the sugar alcohols, and they may cause gas and bloating. For the most part, most people tolerate xylitol, although quite a number of people do get the GI upset, but most of them, almost everybody tolerates erythritol. And the reason for that is that the erythritol actually gets absorbed in the small intestine. So it doesn't make it down to the large intestine, although, you know, maybe 85% of it doesn't make it down to be fermentable. So if you're going to choose a sugar alcohol, erythritol would be the one to go with. So let's take a look at a chart with those in it. So we'll compare the sugar alcohols, and I put erythritol at the top because I believe that that's the best choice. And sorbitol is the worst. Sorbitol in just about everybody causes GI upset, gas, bloating, even diarrhea. So if we look at their sweetness relative to sucrose, erythritol is almost at the top. Erythritol and xylitol are at the top. Xylitol is one, meaning that it's equal in sweetness to sucrose, so you can use it one to one. So if you wanted to use a teaspoon of sucrose, you would substitute it for a teaspoon of xylitol. For erythritol, it's about 80% as sweet. So you'd have to use a little bit more erythritol to get the same effect. But if you look at mannitol and sorbitol, they're 0.5 and 0.6. So you need to use quite a bit more. So the sheer volume of using more to get the same level of sweetness can trigger that fermentation by the gut bacteria. Let's look at the energy. And the energy has to do with how much of that product is actually utilized, absorbed by our bodies versus just utilized as unbreakdownable, if that's a word, fiber. And when you look, erythritol is at the bottom there, 0.21. So it's almost 100% not utilized by our body. So really, if you have a teaspoon of erythritol and you think a teaspoon of sugar is going to be about 20 calories, let's just say, then that teaspoon of erythritol under one calorie. Okay, so that's basically. So when you look at the sweetness per calorie, basically, that's what sweetness per food energy means, you see that erythritol is 15 versus table sugar, which is one, right? For every, because it's comparing it to itself, right? And the others are a lot less. So we're really looking at erythritol being the lowest calorie, the least likely to produce gut upset, and I think the best choice of the bunch. There are several products available, and I'll show you a picture of some of those for erythritol. One of them is called Zero, and it's organic. It's quite expensive because it's a proprietary product. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at Whole Foods, probably any of the larger food chains, the whole natural food chains. The other one is called Sweet Smart, and that's actually quite reasonably priced. It's non-GMO, and it's non-corn. Both of these do not contain corn, soy, gluten, any of those problematic foods. Okay, when you look at this one came, I think I found this on, yeah, this is on Amazon. 4.5 pounds of it for $36. So it's not going to be, it's certainly a lot more expensive than sugar. You can get a 5 pound bag of sugar for probably under $5. I haven't bought one in many years, so I don't know. And this gives you a little bit of information about it. It says all natural, free of GMO, gluten, wheat, soy, and corn, and 0 calories, 0 glycemic index, safe for diabetics, high digestible, tolerable, right? That's what I just talked about, because it gets absorbed, a lot of it gets absorbed in the small intestine. And then 70% as sweet as sugar. So cool, right? So most of it, as I said, is absorbed in the small intestine, and a lot of it is excreted in the urine. So it's been said that if you're one of these people who likes to drink their own urine and you take erythritol, it's probably going to taste quite sweet, because the unmetabolized erythritol gets just absorbed and then spit out in the urine. Only about 10% enters the colon, so you really have to take very large amounts to get that laxative effect, unless you're very, very sensitive or you've got a lot of gut dysbiosis, meaning bad life in the gut. It's generally free of side effects on regular use. In doses over 50 grams, it causes nausea and stomach rumbling. 50 grams is a huge amount. We're not going to be taking in 50 grams at a time unless you're going on a sugar binge and doing it with erythritol. It's more difficult for the intestinal bacteria to digest than any of the other sugar alcohols, so it's less likely to cause gas and bloating. And erythritol is naturally occurring in some foods like pears, melons, grapes, mushrooms, wine, soy sauce, and cheese. So that's probably what gives it some of its sweet flavor. So let's take a look at how cooking affects carbohydrates, because chances are, if you are eating grains or high carbohydrate foods, you are cooking them. Does cooking damage? Well, let's see. Well, cooking accelerates the conversion of starch to sugar. So when you take in a high carbohydrate food that has a lot of starch in it, which would be grains and potatoes and sweet potatoes and those sorts of things, that a lot of that starch is going to be converted to sugar right then in there in the cooking process. So if that's the case, then when you eat that food, you would tend to see a larger increase in blood sugar than if you ate that same food raw. And in fact, I have found that to be true. I'll give you an example. One of the foods that I've eaten, both cooked and raw, is carrots. And in the raw state, they barely raise my blood sugar 10 points, maybe. When I eat them in the cooked state, they send my blood sugar into unhealthy ranges, and sometimes, depending on the amount I'll eat, up to 135. So suffice it to say, I don't eat cooked carrots very much anymore. Occasionally, they're in something that someone else has made for me, but generally, I just don't eat cooked carrots unless it's just a small part of a large meal. So it increases the glycemic index, which means it increases the available calories, because those calories are going to be utilized and burned more quickly. It decreases what's called the resistant starch content, and that would be the starch content that doesn't get digested by us and thus passes through us as non-caloric. And when you look at labels, you'll be able to see what that. High heat, this is the thing. High heat, especially dry heat, it doesn't seem to be as problematic with steaming, but baking causes this, or roasting. High heat creates a substance called acrylamide, which is a known carcinogen. So, all those things said, it's probably in your best interest to avoid or limit the amount of cooked carbohydrate, and especially avoid the baked. And the worst of the things for acrylamide would be things like French fries and chips, but also some surprising things. So, here's a list of the top 20 acrylamide foods by average, by intake in the US. So potato chips and French fries are at the top, even the oven baked ones, because it's the high heat, and potatoes seem to be the worst offenders. And breakfast cereals, again, they're high heat processed. They're not like lightly steamed. Toast, pies, and cakes, you can read through the list and choose, use the list to choose which foods you're going to minimize. So we talk about carbs, and our society in this day and age tends to demonize carbs. There's a ton of low carb diets out there, starting with the Atkins, which was probably the first one to come and gain popularity many, many decades ago. But we've got the Zone diet, we've got the South Beach diet, we've even got more of the non-mainstream diets like the Rainbow Green diet from Gabriel Cousins. That's a low carb diet. There are going to be times when you need a higher carb diet. And I say you generically, maybe not you per se, but there are times there are certain people and conditions under which a higher carb intake is needed. And if this fits you, then you need to look at increasing the amount of good, healthy carbs. So let's take a look at what some of those specific situations are. Generally, it's when there's a need for a large amount of calories because of various conditions, and we'll talk about those right now. And people who need to gain weight, you know, people who are underweight and no matter what they do, they don't gain weight. If they go on like a raw foods diet or a vegan, a low carb diet or a paleo diet, they just like wither away. So these are people who need to eat, gain weight, and they do better. They do okay with a higher carb as long as the carbs are well chosen, that you choose the healthy carbs versus the unhealthy carbs. So the whole foods, things like sweet potatoes and roots tend to be the healthiest of the carb foods. Grains like quinoa and millet, which are non-gluten and don't cause problems. Rice tends to cause a higher glycemic response in a lot of people, as does buckwheat. So I tend to push people towards the millets and the quinoa, which tend to be higher in the protein, but also high carb foods. Competitive athletes oftentimes need to have more carbs. They just need more calories, and just having more protein and fat are going to produce more metabolic byproducts, and they need to have higher carbs. And when you balance the higher carb intake with lots of greens, right? So you have a plate that's 75% vegetables, non-starchy vegetables, and 25% starch, that can be really well balanced and can help to offset some of the negative effects of carbs, which might be to raise the blood sugar. Growing children tend to need more carbs. I know a lot of people who try to raise their kids on a raw, high raw, or all raw diet, and the kids are hungry all the time. When you just introduce a little bit of carb in there, healthy carb like quinoa, it makes a world of difference. For my kids, I would make a big pot of quinoa and put sea vegetables and chopped up green leafies and broccoli and all the brassicas and make that as a meal. And then I would take that and wrap it in a nori sheet. So I was giving them even more of the vegetables and the green, but they were getting a high density. And they do well on that. But my kids just don't appreciate eating an all raw or mostly raw diet. They feel like they need their carbs, and they always get just healthy carbs. And then finally, pregnancy, because you need that the more calories, and unless the person's insulin resistant, in which case a low carb diet during pregnancy is probably more advisable. So let's look at some of the types of carbs. We've briefly gone over this, but I'd like to summarize, you know, the foods that are carbs. Grains, even if they're processed, whole grains or processed grains are all high carb foods. So you might be eating a high carb diet even if you're not eating processed foods. Legumes, fruits, vegetables, fiber, soluble versus insoluble, and let me touch on that a little bit. You'll see that on labels. Soluble fiber is fiber that's water soluble. Things like pectin are soluble fibers, and things like cellulose are insoluble. They just go through intact. Some people's GI tracts are too sensitive to take on much in the way of insoluble fiber. I think of it as a broom going through the intestinal tract, sweeping away a lot of the debris, which is a good thing. But if somebody has Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, which are inflammatory diseases of the bowel, or if they have just irritable bowel and so a little bit of inflammation and leaky gut, the insoluble fiber, too much of it might be too much and can cause GI upset. And then sugar, of course, is a carb. Sugar is the core of the carbs. When we say sugar in our society, we're generally looking at things like sucrose. We're looking at fructose. Looking at high fructose corn syrup, which is probably the worst of all, which doesn't tend to bring up blood sugars, but wreaks havoc in the liver to process it. But other things that are sugar and contain sugar, whether it be sucrose, fructose, or combination, are things like maple syrup, agave nectar, which is mostly fructose, honey, coconut nectar. These are all foods that have been put out as healthy sugars. But in fact, most of them do raise the blood sugars substantially and should be really carefully chosen or avoided in folks with blood sugar imbalance. And finally, sugar alcohols, which we talked about in depth. So these are the types of carbs. And when you're deciding, you know, how much carb to be in your diet, you have to go by how you feel. You can't go by what somebody else tells you, what I tell you, or someone else tells you. For other types of nutrients, there are specific ways to assess. And this is true of carbohydrates. The most common way to test carbohydrate status is to look at your fasting blood glucose. I mean, that is how much sugar is in your blood. And your fasting blood glucose tells you how well your body's able to bring your glucose back down to the baseline. It doesn't tell you a lot about what it's doing with the food in between. It actually is a quite late warning sign of blood glucose imbalance and diabetes. So fasting blood sugar, you can do it through a lab. They take blood out of your vein. You can do it with your own meter. You poke your finger and you put it on the meter. Very easy to test blood glucose. But I like to do the kind of testing we do at home, which would be post-meal. You'll also see that called post-prandial. And then after exercise, blood glucose. So after activities, you can actually see what the various activities and foods in your life do to your blood glucose. Very important stuff. That gives you much better look at how well your body's managing sugar than just relying on the fasting blood glucose. Another way to do more of a global look at it is something called hemoglobin A1C. So hemoglobin A1C is a measure of the glycosylation of your blood cells, your red blood cells. What does glycosylation mean? Well, how much sugar coating is happening in there? So when the hemoglobin A1C is high, meaning a high percentage of your blood cells have sugar on them, that means that your blood sugar has been uncontrolled, even if your blood glucose fasting is normal. So this is a much more sensitive indicator of your carbohydrate, your glucose status. There's something called fructosamine. And just to step back a bit, hemoglobin A1C will give you the average pretty much over a three-month period because that's how long it takes for those red blood cells to replace themselves. But there's another thing that's becoming more popular now called fructosamine that can be measured in the blood. And that gives you more of the average over a month. So between the hemoglobin A1C and the fructosamine, we get an idea of how well controlled it is. So if you're working, you or a family member has a fasting blood glucose, let's just say 85, which is perfectly normal, but you have a hemoglobin A1C of, say, 6.8, that means that your average blood glucose based on your hemoglobin A1C is somewhere in the range of in the 120s, which means not so good. You're getting some high blood sugar spikes. So we want to bring that down. So it gives us a peek into the future of how well controlled we are. And that's when we start to look at all the things that we've looked at in our Before Be Gone program and in terms of the charts that I've given you to evaluate your blood sugar. And finally, insulin is a good assessment because if the insulin is what's secreted by your pancreas in response to carbohydrates, sugar getting into the blood, if the insulin is high, it's going to give you an idea of how well controlled that is. So if the insulin is ultra low, especially after a meal, then that could indicate that you've got some really late stage problems. But generally, that's not going to happen without warning because usually that happens in diabetics who've been that way for a long time and their pancreas finally just gives out. Generally speaking, we find that the fasting insulin is higher than it should be, meaning that the body is becoming insulin resistant. So those are the ways to measure carbohydrates. Here's how to read a label with carbohydrates. So the red is around the total carbohydrate content. But that number can be deceiving. So if you're looking to decide if a certain food is good for you, first of all, if you have to read the labels, I generally don't think it's good for you, but that's beside the point. It should be fresh, like apples don't come with labels generally, although I'll show you a picture of one that does. So total carbohydrate. So in this case, it's 15 grams. The next thing I look at is sugar. So 4 of those grams are sugar. So what's the other 9? Well, 3 of them are sugar alcohols. So that accounts for 7 out of 15. So where's the other 8? 4 of them are fiber. So the sugar alcohols and the fiber are not going to really contribute to your carbohydrate count. So that's 7 out of this. So that's just about half. But what's the other that's not listed? And that would be starches. Okay, the polysaccharides, the starches. So in this particular case, if you're very, very blood sugar sensitive, you may want to avoid this food because it's got 4 grams of sugar. And I generally look at not taking in anything that has more than 2, but that's me because my, you know, I'm genetically programmed for diabetes and all that. So I'm really, really careful. So you just have to find out for yourself. Now, but if you look at the rest of this label, it's really not good food. Wheat flour, which is white, it's refined. So whenever it says wheat versus whole wheat, it means that it's going to be a refined food. Unsweetened chocolate, erythritol, so far so good. Inulin, so inulin is I didn't mention inulin before, but inulin is one of those longer chain starches. So that's where fructooligosaccharides, a whole bunch of fructooligosaccharides put together make inulin, which is, it's like the equivalent of a starch. But it's made up of all these oligos. Oat flour, cocoa powder, evaporated cane juice, so that's sugar, whey protein powder, so that's from a dairy, cornstarch, low glycemic cornstarch, they're saying, natural flavor, salt, baking soda, wheat, gluten, and guar gum. So first of all, this is not a product I would recommend, but it was a good picture that I could find that depicted how to read the label. So when in doubt, eat fresh food. Just eat real food that's come from nature. Doesn't mean that you're not going to have a problem with the carbohydrate content. So for, you know, green apple, which is lower sugar than a red apple, it may be good enough for you to tolerate, but you may not tolerate pineapple, which may be very high in sugar. And that's where testing the blood glucose, and we guide you through that extensively in the Before Be Gone program. So this is a quick look at the carbohydrate content in food. It's a little bit challenging to read on the screen, but you have a printout of it that you can go through. But really, I would go to whfoods.com and then just look up whatever food you're curious about. These are included as PDF documents on the website page, so no worries about not being able to read them in the slide. But there's also a great federal government database, which I refer to in there, so that you can then look up any food that you have in question and figure out what the deal is with it. Let's just take a brief look at some of the special carbohydrate diets and carbohydrate intolerance. So lactose intolerance, you've probably heard people say that, or maybe even yourself found yourself to be lactose intolerant. So lactose is milk sugar. So if a person doesn't have the lactase enzyme to digest the milk sugar, you're going to get problems like gas and bloating and discomfort in your gut. Could be diarrhea as well. It is said that the lactase enzyme is something that we grow out of, that we don't need past the age of 4 or 5 when we're weaned. That's really nice if we get people that are breastfed until they're 4. It's not usually the norm in our society, but it's the norm in our indigenous cultures. So lactose intolerance persists in a lot of people. Some people genetically have adapted to keep and maintain the lactase enzyme. But in general, lactose intolerance is, most adults have some degree of lactose intolerance. Low glycemic diets. Those are for people who have found that they are diabetic, that they tend to have blood sugar swings. They're pre-diabetic, insulin resistant as well. And my belief is that you should eat as many carbohydrates in the whole fresh form as your body tolerates while maintaining healthy blood glucose levels. So I'm not, like, in general, a big fan of just willy-nilly doing a low-carb diet. But for a lot of people, it's necessary because of the blood sugar. But if you know, eat a banana and bananas keep your blood sugar below 100, I have no problem with you eating a banana. I do have a problem with you eating anything with gluten in it, especially if you have any kind of health problems, which understandably, if you're listening to this and you're in the ERC program, you've come to it because you've had a problem with your energy or have had persistent health problems you're trying to avoid. So if you haven't heard enough from me, gluten-free is super important. And it's one of those carbohydrate intolerant diets. It's really the protein that we're intolerant to in gluten, but it comes as a package, like nature provides it, and it's a very high carb food. There's something called the specific carbohydrate diet, And they're only allowing monosaccharides. Disaccharides are disallowed because it's said that the disaccharides aggravate the gut. They become fodder for the bad bacteria, and they can cause bloating and gas. So people and inflammation, people with Crohn's disease often have really good results when they follow a specific diet, carbohydrate diet. My problem with the specific carbohydrate diet, if you do it as it's published, it's extremely high in meat. And the person who wrote the book, The Gaps Diet, she is very anti-vegetarian. She's very anti-vegetables as a source of nutrition. She thinks that they're just condiments and that we should mostly be eating meat. So you can tell I really disagree with that. And I thrive on a vegetarian diet. A lot of people do. And a lot of people thrive on what's called a plant strong diet, which is high plant food. The specific carbohydrate diet, as it's laid out, gets rid of all these foods, which I have a problem with. And they do a lot of fermented foods, which I do enjoy. I think that's great. They think that only fermented vegetables are tolerable. And in the case of people with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, in the acute stage, this is true. So avoiding the fermentable and the monosaccharides, the disaccharides, which are harder to digest and break down, it can be problematic. It can be a good thing to do for many people. But I've created a chart, and I have it in this module for you, is a modified specific carbohydrate diet or GAPS diet. And I've actually incorporated with that, there's two versions of it. One of them is in the digestive module, but a new version of it, which incorporates something else called FODMAPs, fermentable oligosaccharide, disaccharide, monosaccharides, and polyols. And what the people who came up with this plan discovered was that certain of the oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, and recall that those are sugar alcohols, are fermentable by the bad gut bacteria. And when I said fermentable, it's, people who are into sauerkraut and they're like, well, fermentation is good. Why is that bad? Well, fermentation is good when it's by desirable bacteria because it increases their counts and it allows them to grow. But fermentation by bad gut bacteria actually produces more toxic byproducts. So I've created two versions of these special carbohydrate diets. One is just the specific carbohydrate diet with the yes you can and no you can't, and with the if you're going to eat meat, you do grass fed, and you do deep ocean fish. And I've also taken out the dairy products, which they allow some dairy products. And I just think dairy products in general are not good for people who have gut issues, and for most people in general, unless it's very therapeutic. Dairy products like colostrum, for example, can be very healing for the gut. So FODMAPs and specific carbohydrate, SCD, you might see it. It's gaining a lot of popularity these days. Again, I've modified it so it's not such a high meat diet, and you can follow it by using very specific plant-based foods in a small amount of meat if you desire. So let's finish with the good carbs, bad carbs. The good cops, bad cops. Who's there? Who's right? And really, when we look at when we define our food as good or bad, we're getting into very judgmental type things. And when we do that, it tends to trigger the rebel in you to say, oh, well, if you say I can't eat that, I want to eat that. So I'd like you to look at these in terms of the ones that are really healthy for you that you're going to increase, and the ones that are not healthy, you're going to choose to avoid or minimize. And when you talk about it, I choose to avoid or minimize this particular type of food in my diet, it's a much different message that you send to your subconscious than I have to. I get to is even an even more evolved way. I get to avoid gluten because gluten messes up my gut. And when I avoid gluten, I feel much better. It's much easier to say to somebody, or much better for your body to handle and to follow than, oh, I have to avoid gluten. I don't get to eat my favorite foods anymore. Wow, poor me. Okay, so it's all about the attitude, really. So we're going to look at the good carbs, bad carbs, as you can see which carbs are detrimental to your body, so you can choose to minimize them. So let's look. When we're deciding which carbs are good and which carbs are bad, a lot of it is personalized to the individual. Yeah, there's some specific rules that are applicable to all. Refined carbohydrates and simple carbohydrates tend to be more problematic than complex. So foods that have been refined and all the bran and germ and health, nutrition has been stripped away are not going to be good for most people. And sugars for sure in a just isolated sugar over time will lead to the breakdown of the pancreatic ability to produce the insulin and the insulin to be uptake by the cells. Processed tend to be bad for everyone, like I just said. Gut health can temporarily restrict some. So that diet I was just talking about with specific carbohydrate and the GAPs and the FODMAPs, it's recommended that you only follow that temporarily because you are restricting a lot of really healthy foods from there, some good vegetables and some good fruits. So the state of your gut can temporarily restrict you from some. But once your gut is healed, you don't want to go back to eating the processed stuff that created the problem in the first place. So it's so dependent on the individual. Your glucose tolerance plays a major role, meaning how quickly your body causes a rapid rise in the blood sugar and how quickly your body can clear that. So I found when I first started blood sugar testing myself that the very sweet fruits like mango and pineapple and papaya, the ones that were among my favorites, all spiked my blood sugar and I had to avoid them for a long time. Even blueberries made my blood sugar go up somewhat. So I avoided all carbohydrates for a while. You know, whatever's in vegetables I kept doing. And then I introduced things back and now I can tolerate more of them, although I haven't, you know, necessarily tried all of them because I like the way I feel. And I really, it's like, okay, I like the way I feel, so do I really need to play with pineapple? So generally, when you're having to restrict good carbs, like if you look at that list and you're having to leave out spinach or broccoli or something along, cauliflower is one of them that's restricted, know that it's just temporary while your gut is healing. And generally, you go back and you retest and reintroduce to make sure your body tolerates. But generally, those good carbs can be incorporated back once you get your gut flora balanced again, all the good bacteria we talk about in the digestive module, and once you've restored the integrity and healed the leaky gut. So this concludes our module on carbohydrates. I've given you a lot of information to think about. What I'd like to do is kind of bottom line it. So what's next? What do you do with this information? Well, you take a careful look at your diet and you see what foods you're eating that are processed or have processed sugars or carbohydrates in them, which could be detrimental. And you just start to minimize those, replace those with other things. If you're still doing gluten or dairy, as we've been talking about throughout the program and starting in foundations, these are foods that can be problematic, especially for gut healing, but also for hormone balancing. So looking at those foods that are high carbohydrate that you still have in, get a blood glucose meter. Go to the Before Be Gone part of the program, the blood sugar balancing part of the program, and review how to test your blood sugar and get it into balance. And if you haven't done that module yet, plan when you are going to go through that module if you missed going through it live with us. And then finally, take on the attitude that you get to avoid the foods that are not serving you, that you get to eat only foods that are nourishing you, that are full of life and vitality, that make you feel good. Remember that nothing tastes as good as healthy feels. And when you keep that in mind, you decide for yourself that you're willing to do what it takes to get things in balance. And making sure that your carbohydrate intake is optimized to you is really critical to your hormone health and your overall health and well-being. Thank you, and we'll see you on the next video.